And so we had gone, we filed taxes, and we're still in this hotel for this week, and they were going to leave to a different town that week, and he made sure I spent my money. And then when they left, he just left us in that hotel room. I had no money, and I remember using the last of my money, and I went to the grocery store because I needed formula, because I wasn't on WIC or anything at that time. And I had run into my friend's mother at the grocery store, one of my best friends from high school, and so she gave me her daughter's number, and I ended up staying with her for like 2 weeks, and I had gotten a job, and I had gotten my first paycheck, and I threatened him with like the cops to get some of that income tax money because, you know, it was my, you know, both, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was this, oh.
Yes.
And then so I can remember threatening them, saying, I'm going to tell your company that you guys are drinking in that vehicle. And then so then they came and brought me the money. And then I had gotten my apartment. I'd gotten settled. I was working full time. And, you know, everything was going good.
Mm-hmm.
He came back.
Came back into the picture.
Yeah.
So it's a cycle.
Yep.
It's up and down.
Yep.
Up and you build up. You build it back up. And you're taken back down.
Yep.
Eventually.
Yeah. And it was always after I'd gotten everything good and everything was going great. But this was the last time, you know, this.
What age are you by this time?
I'm 24. Well, I'm like right before 24. This was like the day before Mother's Day. And I just remember he was really violent and he took off. And then I just had my dad come and get me. We talked to the landlords and my cousins. They were going to clean out the apartment, and so I wouldn't have a bill. And the landlord, he was really understanding. It was like my landlords, they always knew because they lived on the bottom floor, you know.
Okay.
And
so they actually tolerated it for some time. They worked with you guys.
Yep.
Okay.
So then I had moved with my dad that summer, and I had worked at the bar because the bar would always, you know, take me back to bartend. Mm-hmm. And but that summer I just made a choice, and that's when I moved to Grand Forks, and I was going to be a nurse since I was a CNA, and and I was working at the nursing home in Newtown at that time too. And
I missed something here because you had moved to Fargo, you got your CNA license.
And then I'd moved back, and then I'd moved back to Fargo, and then that's when he left us, and I'd gotten that apartment the second time.
So you went to, from Fargo, you went to Newtown, or to Grand Forks, then to Newtown?
No, to Fargo, I went to Newtown, and then I went for that summer I worked, and then I went to Grand Forks.
Okay.
And I had no car, I had nothing, and my dad had given me his old beater S10 pickup with the camper, and it was all rusty and old.
But hey,
yeah, it worked. Yeah. We loaded up all my clothes. That's all I had was like clothes and a TV, and then he gave me some pots and pans.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Grand Forks that, you know, when school started. Like, I enrolled in the RAIN program, which was recruiting American Indians into nursing, and I had my heart set on nursing. And it's a really good program. So we had drove, and I can remember being so scared because Grand Forks just seemed like a whole different, like I've never been there and mm-hmm. whatever.
So it was a learning curve in how to get around.
But I was really scared because of the controversy, you know, like the logo controversy, because that time it was like kind of in the news, and like that's why I never went to Grand Forks. So then when I went there, it was like the middle of the night, like midnight, and I was lost and I couldn't find the hotel, and I had brought in a babysitter with me. And we were trying to figure out where it was, and then I can remember telling her I was so scared, and then we drove by like the South McDonald's and this car full of kids. They ended up throwing an apple pie at me. You know, and then, I don't know if they threw it specifically at me, you know, but they might have just threw it out the window, and then it hit me, ironically, because I was so scared, you know, and I can remember wanting to turn around and go back home, but then I didn't, you know, and I went to the hotel and then started school there. We moved into the apartment. I had gotten like our school money and whatever, and had gotten the furniture, and ended up buying a cheap vehicle. And gave my dad his vehicle back. And I did good. Like, I did good for a while. And then, but then I partied a lot there. You know?
So, and I was going to ask you about that. While you were with your boyfriend, the father of your daughter.
Yeah.
he was drinking a lot. You mentioned a lot of alcoholism, this and that. But were you drinking alongside? You were drinking alongside
no.
with him?
No.
Not always?
No. Like, when he... we not always. Like, there was just a few instances where we did drink together because we could never drink together because it would become so violent. We would fight, and it was really awful. Mm-hmm. We could never fight together. That's why nobody ever wanted to drink with us or anything because... Mm-hmm. Or if I was drinking with my friends, they didn't want to party with me because he would come and find me, you know, knowing I was out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or I would be looking for him, you know, and then we would fight, you know.
I think that happens a lot.
Yeah.
I think, and so we have domestic violence as an epidemic, you know, especially in an Indian country. And there's a lot of jealousy. You know, stemming from insecurity, I think, and that goes deeper into the abandonment issues that we have as young as young boys or young girls. So I think that's that comes up in a very controlling as a controlling spirit. As they get older, as we get older. Because it goes both ways, I think. You know, one feeds the other. And it's just toxic when you're both together and both insecure, been abandoned. And so it's like you're deathly scared of being left. And so you're hanging on with all your might. And I've seen this. I've seen it. I've experienced it. I familiarize myself with this whole relationship you're talking about. And understand it because, you know, I went through a similar thing. And it's your first one. And you latch on and you hang on for life. And you really think
that this is love. And
this
then,
is forever.
And because, too, you want that life where you have your family, you're married, you have kids. And then in my head, it was going to school. You know, like, I found him. We're going to get married. I'm going to go to college. You know? And we did get married, but it only lasted a year. We got married right after Elena was born. And then we divorced the next year because I'm like, there's no way I could be married to somebody that's, you know... Not somebody, but just I couldn't tolerate that kind of behavior in my family because I didn't want that for my daughter. And so then when I had moved to Grand Forks, you know, that's where I finally was just like, I can't do this. I got to protect my daughter and I got to give her some stability because we had moved like 9 times before she turned 1 year old, you know, back and forth. It was so unstable and I knew I needed to get it together. So when we did, you know, we were good in Grand Forks. I had connected with a couple friends who were single mothers, and we were there and supported each other, but we just went out a lot. We went out every weekend, practically.
It's kind of like everybody has their own issues. And so then you kind of all go together and get through it that way. It's almost like that's your way of coping, right?
Instead of latching onto him, I was latching, our friends, you know, like we were latching onto friends. We'd stay over at each other's house. You know, it was just like none of us wanted to be alone, you know, and that's, and that's what it was. But, you know, that those friendships helped me break away from that, you know, that you know, it was that other dysfunction, you know? And...
So you stayed away from him. This was the final at 24.
Well, I stayed away, but he came back a couple times, but like we never were back together. You know what I mean? In a relationship. He didn't live with us. He came to see Elena a couple times, but then I said, you can't stay here, you know? And then eventually I got pregnant with my second child. And then I knew that was really it, you know. I mean, he was there, you know, when I was pregnant, and then he would help me, like, he was there when my son was born because I was scared to be alone, you know, but, like, in my heart, I just knew that this was it, you know, because I could never trust that somebody could take care and love my kids without hurting me, you know, and so that's what I had in my head.
And so you were about how old when your son was born?
I was almost 28.
Okay. So you had about a good 4 years in between there of being with friends, being single parent, and trying to get through this. Trying to get through life.
So then, like everything. But then when I got pregnant with my son, I was scared in Grand Forks because I didn't have, like, I mean, I had my friends, but I was too scared to think that I could do it on my own. So I moved to Bismarck that summer in July. I moved to Bismarck the month before my son was born. I moved, and because my daughter's grandmother, they were a big part of our life, and they said they were going to help. And I mean, just that comfort of knowing that somebody was there. My mother lived in Kildare at the time, and she said she would come and help. And then my son was 3 years old, and then my mother had gotten into a car accident, and she died. Oh, you know, she was killed by a drunk driver, like 3 months when he was born. So then it was like everything that I thought was going to happen didn't happen, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had enrolled in school, and I got, you know, was going into the nursing. And then I was like, to deal with my mother's death, that was like that was really hard. And then my son had gotten sick from 3 months to 11 months. Every month he'd end up in the hospital because he had gotten RSV. Then every month he would get pneumonia, and it was just like he had to do breathing treatments like every 2 to 4 hours, like for like every day, you know. And then it was just like he would get sick, and then he'd go in the hospital, and then he'd get better, and then he would get sick again. And I just he almost lost him twice. And then, like, when he'd get better, though, then I would take off. You know, my daughter's grandma said, you need a break, just go. So then, like, I would drink. And yep. And so I would take off and just go and wallow in my own sorrows, you know. But then I'd have to go back home, you know. Like, I'd have my little break and go back home. And then, during that time, I never dealt with, you know, my mother. Because by then, too, like, we were really close, you know, even because, like, I had forgiven her from all the stuff that happened in the past, because she had, like, she was sober for 15 years, you know, mm-hmm. and so we established a relationship when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And I'd gotten really close to her when I came back after my dad and my stepmom got divorced. Mm-hmm. And so she was a part of my life, you know, and then so she took me and my baby in and whatnot, and dealt with me going back and forth with my daughter's, my firstborn's dad, and then losing her was really hard. Mm-hmm. And then it was just trying to get through that and then go to school, and I was working, and I just, like, had a breakdown. And then 1 year after she died, because it was, like, that next year, and it was still, like, so hurtful and painful that I remember I went and I had gotten drunk, and then that night I came home and I just remember just wanting to die again, you know, and because it was just so hard. Mm-hmm. And I remember cutting myself because, like, I used to cut myself, like, when I in the early stages of, like, my dysfunctional relationship with my daughter's dad, because it just would hurt so bad. And I don't know why I did it, but I did it, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to die, but I just cut to feel, like, alive, you know. Yeah. And then I don't know, it was, like, a weird process that, you know, happened. I don't understand it, but I did it. But then I remember that year later after my mother had died, and I had gone and I drank, and then I cut myself, and I just remember just cutting and cutting and cutting, like, just thinking, can I do it this time, you know? But then I could, in the back of my head, it's like, I have my kids, you know, because, like, I had a friend who had committed suicide, and she had her kids, and I just seen what it did to her kids, you know? Uh-huh. And that was always in my head, you know, because, like, I just felt like I couldn't do it, you know? And then, but then, like, even though, like, I was getting the idea of wanting to do that and knowing my kids needed me, they needed me, you know? It was just, like, there was a thought in my head that was, like, I'm either going to be like this for the rest of my life and my kids are going to get taken away from me, or I'm going to straighten up and I'm going to make better choices to, you know, get that stability and build that foundation for my kids.
The kids, your kids saved your life.
Yep. Yeah.
Their existence.
Yep. Mm. So I had called my cousin in the middle of the night, and I was crying to him, telling him, and he just listened to me and everything. And then that next day I had called my aunt, because I had called her a couple months prior to that, you know, and telling her what's going on and whatever. And she said that whenever I was ready to go to treatment, you know, it was ready. It was there, you know. And she had lived down in Eagle Butte. So I had called her that next day And then she sent her daughter up, and then they just came and got me, and I'd gotten stuff situated for my kids. And then I left. And I had went to my aunt's house, and I, like, kind of detoxed for, like, 4 days, you know? Mm-hmm. And
until I... Are you still 28?
Yep. I'm about 29.
Okay.
And I had gotten into, started the treatment. I lived over, you know, their little halfway house, and they, you know, lived with the other gals that, you know, were in treatment too. And I just went to the treatment and kind of talked about everything, and they really helped me cope with my feelings. 'Cause, like, the biggest thing was I never have been able to deal with my feelings. And when I lived in Grand Forks too, like, I had gotten myself into counseling, and I was in counseling for about almost 2 years, you know? And then in my early 20s too, my mother had me in counseling. She had me go see her counselor. And so, I mean, like, I just never utilized their strategies that they had given me, you know? And okay. But in Grand Forks, I really did. I took it serious because I didn't want to go back, you know, and keep doing what I was doing. And then when I had gone to Eagle Butte, it was just kind of like I lost all of that because I had withdrawn, and I just couldn't, I wasn't thinking straight, you know, because I had just withdrawn. And so they really helped me. Like, I just have a, there's always going to be that place in my heart for the treatment center in Eagle Butte. I don't even remember what it's called.
Oh, wow.
And they helped me. Their RAs were a good support. I'm friends with them to this day, one of them. And, I mean, they just kind of touch base with me every now and then. And, when I had gotten back home, well, too, then while I was in treatment, it was like my stepmother had been harassing me. You know, she would, like, send me messages because it was like my daughter had gone with one of my cousins. And then it was like my sister had him for a week. My dad would check on him, and he just didn't want him staying there. So then he took him for that second week. And then my stepmom had, she was going through health issues, and she was really upset that it got put on her to have to take care of him. And then so she would send me, like, such hateful messages while I was in treatment. And it was just, like, it just messed with my head. It was just, like, I didn't understand. Like, I'm here trying to get help. And then it's, like, no support, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it was, like, I couldn't focus, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I did. But then it was, like, constant worry about my kids, too, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it was, like... So then my daughter's dad, he had, you know, because he had always, you know, it's like he had picked my son up. And then so he took him for that last week. It was like the last 2 weeks he had, then he had picked up my daughter too. Mm-hmm. And so he took him home for like the last 2 weeks to my apartment. And then I finished it out, but I finished I think it was, I want to say it was 40 days that I was gone, but then I'm not sure if it was 28 or 40 days. But it was like 4 weeks. I had gone home at Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did that help you?
Oops.
I'm sorry. Did it help you?
Yeah, it did. Like it helped me. I had gotten some clarity. I had just taken time to... knowing that if I didn't help myself, I couldn't help my family, you know? I can't take care of my kids if I can't take care of myself. And they had instilled that in my head, and to just have to be scared and be by myself and cut off from all of this, you know, stuff in the world that we're influenced by. Like, I had to step outside and, like, collect myself and, you know, like, have some good... just some prayers and good talking to, and just other sharing stories, you know, just remembering why we're here, you know, and like what our purpose is in this life, you know, and seeing others who had it worse off than me, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, it's just like, I know I can get it together and I can take care of my kids. I do not want my kids taken away from me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was just like, Because if I continue down that road, this is what it's going to be for me, you know? And so that's what I took from it. And so when I get home and, you know, I did good, I enrolled back in school, and then I just kept going to school.
That, you know, everything, this whole story has just been just, I can't even believe.
I can't believe you're
here today.
Yeah.
And it, you know, successful, graduated with a bachelor's degree. I mean, you have three children.
Yep.
Single parent. I know you've had trials even beyond this point.
Yep.
Just only because I know you yep. personally. And I of course, I didn't know all of these yep. things. And I just... And you're so positive. You're very full of life. You're just, you have light in you. And I'm amazed, you know, at your resiliency. I really am amazed. And these are the stories that people need to hear. All of these things happen, but that doesn't mean we have to stay a victim.
Yes, exactly. And you know, it's like all of this stuff, you know, like you go through life and... I think a lot, you know, like, because I try to rationalize all this stuff, like, why me? Why did this happen to me, you know? And I can put myself in my mother's shoes, you know, because I ask questions and I ask, like, how, you know, what it was like for her, you know? And so we shared, like, what it was like for her so I could understand, you know, this is my life, you know, from her choices and then from... Like, visiting, like, I have a grandmother that I visit, you know, and so, like, I can really understand, like, how everything evolved to, like, where we are today, you know? Mm-hmm. And I look back at my own, you know, and I just think what I want for my kids, you know, and, like, everything happens, you know, for this reason, and we all interact, and we're all connected in some way. We all can learn from each other. We can all take that positive, mm-hmm. you know, that there's something good and there's something bad. And it's whatever choice we make, you know, that's what, you know, takes us to that next step.
And I remember visiting with you before,
yeah.
and this sticks with me, what you had said, and it's what you're talking about now, turning a negative into a positive.
Yeah.
That's everything. You take a negative and you just have an attitude of it's unacceptable.
Yep.
And you make it into a positive.
Yes. Oh, what I wanted to say. It just reminded me of what I was going to say. And well, because like all of this stuff that has happened in my life, you know, I think, you know, yes, a lot of it was negative, but like all these different people that I can meet, like I could, you know, I can relate to different people with their different experiences and, you know, to say, hey, you know, like, yes, this stuff happened. It sucks. But like what's done is done. And it's like how you're going to move forward and just learn from it, accept it and be able to let it go and know what you want in your life, you know, to be successful, you know.
Mm-hmm. And to allow them to choose and define what success is yes. for themselves.
Yeah.
How they see that.
Yeah.
That's their vision.
Mm-hmm.
Like to each his own.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yep.
But to not settle for less.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So to have, to withhold high standards, to see your own personal vision.
Yeah.
And just go and get through it, mm-hmm. see through it, no matter what social challenges come along in your path.
Yeah.
Keep the end in mind.
Yes.
And get help. Have a support system
yep.
to get through it.
Yep.
And so that you can reach your goal.
Yep.
You know, I really think that this really sheds light on the need to have an Indian center
mm-hmm.
here. To have a supportive network.
Yep.
For life,
yeah,
to get through just life, and I am so glad to hear this because, I mean, I've always personally thought it was a need, of course, and that's, you know, the reason for incorporating. But it was really, you know, the vision of seeing it as a life center,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah,
and bringing in our culture,
yep.
Bringing in a unified place where all these different tribal backgrounds can come one place, not saying one way is the right way over another way,
yeah,
but bringing it all in, and unity, allowing our Native American people to pick and choose what they want to do.
Yep.
What they want to follow. With this, there are, and I spoke yesterday with in an interview who was somebody enrolled in Turtle Mountain and didn't have access to the Turtle Mountain ways, the tradition practice. She was actually taught to, because she lived in Bismarck, she was actually taught by somebody that was in Standing Rock.
Yep.
So she practices Dakota ways.
Yeah.
But we're hungry for to practice our own Native American ways.
Yeah.
There are similarities per tribe, but there are slight differences amongst each tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a need. I can hear that. There's a need for us to unify, to have a supportive network to do the teaching of it to our children as well.
Yeah.
So we're not 30, 40, 50 years old just barely trying to learn. And so this is something that moves me as well. Personal experience of all the trauma. I know my parents had trauma before me.
Yeah.
And so I know my grandma and grandpa had trauma before them. And so there's a cycle. I think what it sounds like is that there's a vision of a cycle to be broken.
Yeah, people need to talk about it. I mean, a lot of people, they don't want to talk about it because it brings shame to the family or whatever, you know? And we're very proud people, you know? And I think the more people can share their stories and actually bring awareness, you know, and that'll help them heal. And it'd also be like, hey, yeah, this happened, you know? And I mean, it's just like, it happened, and you have to learn from it and be able to let it go and move forward, you know? And that's all part of, like, a healing process, you know?
So, oh, my goodness. And, you know, I'm just really, I'm in awe here because I hear really spiritual things throughout this whole process. It was just this seed of faith, the Holy Spirit, as you, I was taught.
Yeah.
That was in you, taking care of you the whole time.
Yeah, like my...
Speaking to you.
Through my whole life, like every dark moment, you know, like I had always had something. I can... Like I've always had a friend that was... that come from a family of high faith, like in high school, in elementary school, even... Riding the bus home from California, I sat next to a Mormon and he was talking about faith and whatnot, you know, and like I've always been, you know, connected with somebody who has that high faith, you know. I have relatives that are, you know, that practice our native ways, you know, and it's just, it's all, I want to say it's like all connected somehow, you know, like we all have our beliefs and our faith, you know, but there's that one creator, you know, and he sends us our message, you know, through whatever he channels it, whatever, with whatever he can, so then he can give us that understanding, you know.
Yeah, so to kind of just agree that there's one God.
Yep.
And not worry about those little traditional, the little how you do it, what you do, kind of, because that gets religious, like in the church, for example. You know, I remember growing up as an Episcopalian, and we sang Dakota in the songs. And but it was, you know, from the Bible. We believed in the Bible and everything. And I learned as I grew up that it is similar to Catholic.
Yep.
And I didn't know that for so many years, actually, until just a few years ago. And my husband is Catholic. And so you have to pick and choose once you, you know, and I hadn't even been practicing, you know, faithfully and, and obediently my own Episcopalian practice. And so I found a church here in Bismarck called All Nations Assembly of God.
Yeah.
And why I went there is because I was seeking where the Native American population was to connect. And that it had a focus on us.
Yeah.
It spoke to us. It wasn't, because so many times I think we're used to kind of being ignored.
Yeah.
Kind of like we're not there.
Yeah.
You can be in a whole room of, I just kind of, it's kind of that lateral oppression kind of thing. Whether non-natives are intentionally doing it or not. Because we're just different.
Yeah. I don't think they know. You know what I mean? Because, like, I grew up, like, off the reservation for a lot of my life, you know. I grew up mostly in Fargo, and then, like, I didn't see, like, prejudice or anything, you know. But maybe I just didn't know about it, you know. I never had no experience at that time. But then we moved to a rural community, and I experienced it every single day of the time that I was there, you know. People would call me Pocahontas and Danielson and Coffee Bean and Juan Valdez, which didn't really like.
And but, did you take offense?
Yeah, it hurt me bad. Like, okay. I got into depression and it was so miserable, you know, and it stuck with me my whole, you know, like, I just didn't understand it, you know. And then, but I mean, like, I got through it. And I eventually had ran into one of the girls, like, when I had moved to Newtown. I was in speech and drama and stuff, you know, and I had run into one of the girls that was really awful to me, and she apologized to me.
Now, you know? is this, it's a non-native that was name calling, and so is it white Caucasian?
Yeah.
That were name calling? Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, just want to clarify.
And then, I mean, so when I looked back at that, you know, it's like I had the experience of off, you know, like how it was in Fargo. It was like a more urbanized area. And then to this rural development community, you know, it was more ignorance, you know. And then moving to on the reservation. When I first moved to the reservation and I went to school, like they picked on me too. You know, and like, because, and then I was so scared and I sat with the non-natives that first couple weeks of school. and then I had gotten some friends who like took me under and they're like, come sit with us, you know, and they became my best friends, you know, but it was just like.
The non-natives did?
Yeah, no, the natives
actually did.
Yep, the natives.
was it kind of like, okay, a new person coming in, even though you're tribal.
Yep.
And you're from there, but they just, they're territorial.
Yeah. Somebody wanted to beat me up. She didn't know who I was, but I was so happy and bubbly, you know, it just irritated that person, you know, and it was her own ignorance, you know,
right.
But then like the new friends that I had, you know, they stuck up for me until then people got to know me. And then it was this, then I was part of the community and I got to know my friends and relatives and, you know, but...
Threatened.
Yeah.
They were threatened.
I don't know what it was, you know. It was just, I was different.
Yeah.
And then plus, like, I mean, and then I think, you know, like, the time that I was there, you know, and all of my classmates and stuff, you know, it broke down some of that barrier too, you know, like, influenced them some way. Because I think, but then it was... I mean, but then, you know, I did make bad choices after that, you know, but it's just, like, to see... That there's, I don't know, like, it just broke down some social barrier, I think.
So you mentioned a little bit about that. If you could just kind of repeat, how did you break down that you let them know it was safe? You kind of, by being bubbly with them and being very more loving to them?
Yeah, I just kind of, like, when people would, you know, they'd always...
To fight you or...
Yeah, I just kept a positive attitude and then I just didn't let it bother me. And I just continued to just associate with the ones that, you know...
Walked away.
Yeah.
That you used
or they to... would say some... They, like, everybody at school really liked to joke around and tease a lot, you know, and I wasn't familiar, you know, because, like, I'm really gullible and then... It took me a long time to adapt to being teased, you know, because, like, I'm so insecure, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so it was, like, it was hard for me to adapt to that, but now I can do it, you know, because I've connected with my family and my friends. And
And so what school was this at? Did you say it was tribal school?
Yep, that was, well, I don't, it was in Newtown.
In their Newtown. High
school. It was a public school. Yeah.
Okay, so that has a mixture of Caucasian and Native American.
Yep.
Okay, I see. I too experienced the difference between a rural Caucasian community versus not so much a public school, but a tribal school. So I went drastic.
Yeah.
I went like from rural. Well, first I went from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know color was different or anything until I moved to Wilmot, South Dakota, into a rural little Caucasian rural town, farmer town. We lived rural, but so we rode bus and things. I remember the school was so small. I mean, there was me and two other Native Americans in our class. There was some classes that didn't have, I mean, there was only one, like, seventh grade. And there were some grades that didn't have any Native Americans in them. It was so it was a real small network.
And I think, you know, like, each community, you know, like when I lived in that rural community, there was a Native family that lived there, you know, but they grew up there. You know what I mean? So nobody raised heck with them. You know what I mean? Because they were there and they were accustomed to the community. And so I think that's how it is in any community, like, because there's different, I don't know what you would call it, like stereotypes or whatnot, even with the non-natives, you know, like Caucasians, like even with religion, even with like if you're poor or if you're rich, you know, there's always some sort of stereotype in any, you know what I mean? But it's just, there's these barriers, cultural barriers, language barriers, religious barriers, you know, everything. There's always something. It's like an intertwine of, you know, just different little roadblocks. And if you can get over those roadblocks and learn and, like, you know, break them down, then it just makes everything a lot more smooth and peaceful and everything more happier.
So it sounds like, so to really try to accept and adopt the mindset of being open. Open-minded, just kind of a heart of love. Love people for human humanity, and instead of race and all, you know, whether it's what political party you're in or what, you know, all these different, like you said, these buckets. So I agree. I agree. It's a human factor. We all have feelings. We all have our own beliefs. We should respect them all and not be judgmental.
And just to remember where you come from. Like, even if you are so successful in your life, you know, you have to remember where you came from, your roots, and just, you know, you get so busy every day doing your daily tasks, and you just have to remember where you came from and what it took to get there. And because everybody, some people, you know, just can get so desensitized by the everyday motion and just getting through the day, or just like worrying about whatever their duties are, you know, and then when they talk to somebody who isn't, you know, at their level, you know, and then they just assume that they should know, you know. It's just like, you have to just remember and, you know, just stop and say a kind word, or, you know, just like look at somebody as an equal instead of, you know.
And would you say this to our own Native American people? As well as the non-Native American people. Thank you so much, Heather. I really enjoyed this interview, and I know that it's going to help other people.
Thank you for having me.